Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Please enjoy.
Hello, thank you for joining the program, and I hope you've had a great week. Recently, I came across a blog on the Huffington Post simply labeled Hell. It was written by Bill Halamandaris, chairman and co-founder of the Heart of America Foundation, which, and I quote, provides children in need everywhere with the tools to read, succeed, and make a difference. Primarily, the foundation distributes books and so on to needy children and encourages volunteerism to make a difference in the community. Anyway, the blog reads like this. What does hell look like? Is it fiery and hot or dark and cold? Does it exist at all outside of our minds? I visited hell in 1992. It was in an AIDS ward in an LA hospital. There I met a young black woman clinging to life but already in purgatory. She was in a gray place, neither dark nor light, hot nor cold, caught in transition between the best and worst of her life. She was tormented by the demons of her past, years on the street and a dependence on drugs, but sustained by love. The staff attending her was literally counting the days. Most were surprised that she'd held on so long. What kept her alive, I was told, was her fierce determination to make sure her six-year-old daughter was taken care of after she was gone. The word hell comes from the Old English. Literally, it means to separate or to build a wall around. To be held was to be shut off from. All who love can relate to the torment this woman felt at the thought of being separated from the one she loved most deeply. It was truly hell. Diabolic comes from a word meaning to divide. Diabolic forces separate us from each other and God. In our lives, they find expression in ego, anger, pride, nationalism, racism, envy, ignorance, and greed. These are the forces of darkness. With the affluence of our society and the increasing polarization of resources, separating ourselves from others becomes easier and at times seems almost inevitable. Increasingly, we are tempted to create boundaries of geography, blood, and race. It is not difficult to become convinced of our preciousness, independence, and self-sufficiency. It's not difficult to feel threatened by those who look or seem different. But when we close others out, we shut ourselves in. We walk willingly into a hell of our own making. The walls we put up for our protection serve only to isolate us, leaving us lonely and alone. In the process of trying to protect ourselves, we only diminish ourselves. By contrast, heaven means harmony. If demonic forces divide, love unites. The heaven on earth will not arrive until we are able to get beyond the superficial elements that divide us and realize that the only thing that separates us from God and each other is the belief that we are separate. Hell is here, it is now, not then. Now, while I'm not so certain about the word etymologies he claims, we can certainly relate to the message he's passing on. It's a nice introduction to our continued discussion on the role of giving in to the development of love. Remember that last week we spoke quite extensively on how we have to nurture the mind of generosity, a mind willing to give away everything, even one's own body. But not only can we give away what we have, which may be quite little, but we can also enhance our mind of generosity by offering vast quantities of imagined delights, like huge banquets, skies of sublime music, endless fields of flowers, and so on. Using our imagination and mental capacities like this, we can create unlimited generosity. We can imagine giving all beings everywhere whatever they need to make life happy and fulfilling. And you may remember we quoted verses from Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life that expresses this extensively. We can also make vast imagined offerings to the highly realized beings who actually don't need anything. Like, for instance, those in the Guru Puja. from expansive, well-fashioned vessels, radiant and precious, flow gently forth for streams of purifying nectars. Flowers, incense, light, perfume, food and music, trees and beautiful flowers, singly and in well-arranged garlands, fill the earth and sky. The azure smoke of sweet fragrance incense billows in the heavens as blue summer clouds. From suns, moons, glittering jewels, and a host of flaming lamps, light frolics joyfully, dispelling the darkness of a myriad worlds. Scented with camphor, sandalwood, and saffron, great seas of perfume swirl out to the horizon. Nourishing food and drink of 100 flavors and victuals of gods and men are heaped up in a Mount Meru. From an endless diversity of various instruments comes music which fills the three realms. Whatever is beautiful, wholesome, and good we can visualize and offer, even computers, smartphones, and Ferraris. How to do this to maximum effect is explained in the Sangha's Spiritual Levels of the Bodhisattva, which is quoted by Namkapel in Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, the text we've been following over the last weeks. Bodhisattvas who have gone into solitude and have gathered their thoughts inwardly should purify their thoughts of selfishness, and from the bottom of their hearts with sincere faith should practice generosity out of their concern for all, imagining a limitless, huge, and expansive variety of things, as well as providing sentient beings with actual gifts. In doing so, a bodhisattva will expand his accumulations of merit limitlessly and with a little hardship. This is a practice for bodhisattvas who are endowed with great intelligence. You can see that not only will this kind of practice bring us lots of happiness in this life, but due to the positive potential it generates, even greater satisfaction in coming lives. And now, before we go any further with this text, let's set our motivation as we usually do. In line with developing great love and practicing a vast generosity, let's think of bodhicitta, the mind that wants to benefit all beings in whatever way possible, but especially leading them to enlightenment. This is said to be the greatest motivation, bringing clouds of positive potential, because it focuses on the benefit of all living beings. The object of the motivation is vast, so the positive potential is also vast. So let's take a moment to look deeply into our mind and see why we are tuned in here today. Thank you. Now to go back to mind training like the rays of the sun. In quoting from the Spiritual Levels of the Bodhisattva, Namkapel says that a Sangha's teaching can be explained in terms of giving to the environment and giving to the inhabitants of the environment. He then divides the latter into those not on the spiritual path and those who do follow a spiritual path. Here, I think with spiritual path, he is specifically referring to the Buddhist spiritual path. And he takes as the basis of giving the transformation of one's body into everything that others need, as we discussed in last week's program. Namkapel first addresses generosity to those not on the spiritual path. To understand what he writes, we need to know something about the Buddhist cosmology, which I guess most of you are familiar with. However, for any listeners not in the know, let's take a quick tour through it. Basically, Buddhism talks of six realms within conditioned existence or samsara. The lowest are the hell realms, and there are a number of these. The main hells are the eight hot and eight cold hells, which increase in the amount of suffering experienced as one descends. The hells are named according to what the beings there go through. For instance, in the hot reviving hell, a being is born with weapons in hand and great aggression with which to attack all the other beings there. The denizens hack at each other until they die, but then are revived again and again to repeat the process endlessly. The text also mentions the blistering hell. This is a cold hell where beings are born in the dark without shelter or clothes, and where it is so cold that their skin constantly blisters. Needless to say, beings stay for a very long time in these hells. The great hells are surrounded by lesser hells, where beings undergo various sufferings, such as having to cross swamps of sewage and other foul substances, or wandering through forests of trees with razor-sharp leaves. In the occasional hells, beings have some time off between sufferings. Then the next realm is the realm of the hungry spirits or pretas. These are beings characterized by constant dissatisfaction and unfulfillment, and are described mainly as constantly hungry and thirsty, but never being able to find food and drink. They have large bellies and tiny mouths and thin necks, and even when they find food, they can't swallow it because it harms them, like producing burning in their stomachs. We know the next realm well. It is the animal realm, which includes all the mammals, birds, insects, reptiles, fish, and so on. This realm is characterized by ignorance and stupidity, as animals cannot plan for the future or follow the Dharma. They exist off instinct and impulse. The human realm is ours, and I don't think I need to go into any detail about what it's like to be an ordinary ignorant human being. In Buddhism, ours is regarded as the best realm, as we have enough intelligence to recognize pleasure and suffering and to do something about freeing ourselves from the samsaric experience that leads to them. Then there is the Asura realm, where beings are very competitive and like fighting each other and the gods of the realm above them. They are not like the beings in the reviving hell, though, but from what I understand are more like tribal warriors who don't get on very well with their neighbors, if you know what I mean. The sixth realm is the realm of the gods, where you will mainly find pleasure and delights with very little suffering. There are a number of god levels, but this is not the place to go into all of those. If you like, you can draw a kind of parallel with archetypes of human psychology. For instance, when we humans live lives of great aggression, always fighting with others, intensely claustrophobic and vicious, we are looking into a hell realm. Perhaps we can think of people in the worst jails in the world. Then when we see people who can never be satisfied, no matter how much they have or obtain, we are looking into preta psychology. Very poor people, always lacking nutrition, like those in the worst poverty-stricken places, may have this type of mind. Those suffering from kwashiorkor are like pretas. But even some very rich people can live with preta mind, when no matter how much money is in the bank or how vast the mansion, nothing can ever be enough. When we act purely on instinct and without intelligence or thought, we can say we are psychologically reaching towards the animal realm. The human realm is marked by great desire, and this we are quite familiar with. Look at a person in a middle management job who has great ambition and does everything possible to undermine peers and take over from the boss, and you may be looking at an Asura mind. Finally, the CEO of a rich and successful company may have a god-type mind of living a life of great pleasure and ease and very little dissatisfaction. You can find more information on these realms in Tibetan Buddhist books like Lama Tsongkhapa's Great Treatise on the Stages of the Path to Enlightenment, or Geshe Loden's book The Path to Enlightenment in Tibetan Buddhism. So now, with this information at hand, let's see what Namkha Pel has to say about offering to those not on the spiritual path. In other words, those in the six realms who are not practicing the Buddha's teachings. Remember, he is writing about mentally transforming our body into substances and objects useful to those we are trying to benefit. He writes, we should first give our bodies to the beings in the eight hot hells, such as the reviving hell. Then to the beings in the eight cold hells, such as the blistering hell. Then we should give to beings in the surrounding hells and to beings in the occasional hells, where the sufferings are felt intermittently. To these beings, we should give whatever we can, transforming everything just as an alchemical elixir changes iron into gold. We should imagine that those beings attain lives with the freedom and opportunity to practice the doctrine. We should think that they are enriched with the seven jewels of an exalted being, as well as the seven good qualities of high status. And now, just to clarify, the seven jewels of an exalted being are confidence in the law of cause and effect, ethical discipline, generosity, listening to teachings, a sense of shame, consideration for others, and intelligence awareness, discriminating between meaningful and meaningless activities. The seven good qualities of higher status are a long life, magnificent form and personality, belonging to a noble family, being prosperous and influential, being readily believed by others, having great power, and having a strong body and courageous mind. You may argue that wanting qualities such as these is surely just a worldly concern, and people on a spiritual path shouldn't even think of such things. And this would be true if only you wanted these qualities for a happy life in this world. However, while these qualities are desirable in a purely worldly sense, they're also desirable in a Dharma understanding. That is, because with them, we're in a much better position to help others. For instance, if we are prosperous and influential, we can affect a great many more people than if we were relatively unsuccessful and without influence or charisma. Therefore, if we were a good, prosperous, and influential Dharma practitioner, we could draw to our side and help great numbers of disciples and students. But if we're great practitioners but poor and a bit wretched in a conventional sense, we may not be able to help others all that much. There's a story of a top student of Buddhism who outshone all his classmates at knowledge and debate. He was always looking forward to scoring points of his fellow students and grew to be a highly respected scholar and practitioner. Then one day, he heard of a very great and highly realized master who lived on an island in the middle of a river. Thinking he might gain something from such a master, he decided to visit him. He traveled to the river, where he found a ferryman to take him to the island. When he got there, he searched high and low for this great master, but could only find a very ragged, dirty, and decrepit individual who seemed like the outcast from a fishing boat. Eventually, a bit frustrated, the student approached this bag of rags and bones and asked for the master by name. I'm sure you've guessed that this old ragged individual was actually the master, but when he told the student, the young man couldn't believe it. Still, he decided that, as he'd come such a long way, he should at least talk to the old man, and in due course, he asked him about his practice. The old man told him that all he did was recite one mantra. That was all he did. The student asked him to name the mantra, and when he did, the student became even more disillusioned. This old man cannot be a great master, he thought. He only has one mantra practice, and even then, he doesn't know how to pronounce the mantra properly. So, with some disdain, he told the old man that his pronunciation was off, and he could never be successful reciting a single mantra so imperfectly. The old man humbly apologized and asked how to pronounce the mantra properly. The student told him. The old man repeated the new pronunciation a few times to get used to it, and then thanked the student for correcting him. The student, however, decided he wouldn't waste any more time on the island, and so got back into the boat and told the ferryman to return him to the mainland. Somewhere across the river, the student heard someone call out to him. He looked up and saw the old man waving at him and hurrying across the water to catch up with the boat. "I'm so sorry," said the old man, "but I've forgotten how to pronounce the mantra. Please can you tell me again?" The student, seeing the old man running on the water, realized that in fact he was a highly accomplished being and was thoroughly embarrassed by his arrogance. Stammering, he apologized to the old man and went on his way much chastened. Now, of course, I don't know if the old man wasn't a renowned teacher through choice or through other forbidding conditions, but living as an old castaway on a lonely island certainly would not help him attract multitudes of disciples. In a more community-minded setting with lots of resources, he might have been a very great teacher. The most important point, of course, about having excellent resources, body, and reputation is motivation. If our motivation for attaining the good qualities of high status is to have power and prestige for a comfortable life, it's not a Buddhist motivation. However, if we obtain these qualities purely so we can best help others, it can be the best kind of motivation. The first motivation is negative, but the second is positive. We have to be careful, though. It's very easy to say, I want these things to best benefit others, when our underlying purpose is actually just self-benefit. The ego is a sly and clever operative and likes to subvert a spiritual practice for its own ends. But let's return to Namkapel's commentary. He continues to say, just as a precious wish-fulfilling jewel provides whatever we desire, such as food and clothing, so should we imagine that in giving away our bodies, they grant all wishes, manifest as food imbued with 100 flavors, clothing to the value of 1,000 gold coins, mansions with 500 floors, excellent companions who act only as an inspiration, who are associated with enjoyment, who delight in whatever objects are to be enjoyed, and who, surrounded by their possessions, are replete with everything. They are also to be imagined as being favorable factors for the accomplishment of the very highest teachings of the Great Vehicle. Similarly, since the principal external influence is a well-qualified and virtuous spiritual friend of the Great Vehicle, we should visualize our bodies as providing the basis for hearing, contemplation, and practicing the doctrine. External factors such as scriptures of Sutra and Tantra, and internal ones such as the 7 jewels of an exalted being and the 3 precious trainings in ethics, meditative stability, and discriminating intelligence. Essentially, these generate love and compassion in individuals' mind streams, acting as a wellspring for the awakening mind. We should then imagine that through their practice of the 6 transcending perfections, they reach the culmination of the 2 accumulations, Buddhahood, where their mind streams are endowed with the eternal delight of the perfect body of truth. So, as we visualize giving away our body, it becomes like a jewel that grants all the wishes of the hell beings, not only freeing them from all the various sufferings of hell, but also giving them very delicious foods, perhaps caviar, truffles, and porcelana chocolate bars from Amadei, clothing from such fashion houses as Gucci, Yves Saint Laurent, Versace, Christian Dior, and Calvin Klein, and palaces such as the Forbidden City in Beijing, the Palace of Versailles, or the Potala Palace in Tibet. I'm talking about palaces. I don't think any of these I mentioned has 500 floors, though the Potala does have 1,000 rooms. Actually, in one of his books, His Holiness the Dalai Lama said living in the Potala when he was young was a cold and rather dreary experience, and he liked the summer palace, Norbalinka, a lot better. And would you really be happy in a mansion with 500 floors? What would be the purpose? It would be difficult enough to fully occupy one floor, never mind 500. And imagine trying to keep such a building clean and well-maintained. What a nightmare. However, if someone wished for such a dwelling, we are compelled to transform our body into it for them. Then I guess that in the hell realms, it's not so easy to find friends. Everybody is suffering and hating so much that if a little relief comes from harming some other being there, one will do it without so much as a qualm. But we all want good companions, don't we? It's one of the 3 things, with good health and good resources, that makes samsaric life at least bearable. So recognizing this, for the hell beings we can transform our body into wonderful companions, with the wit of Oscar Wilde, Dorothy Parker, or even Woody Allen, and the wealth of Bill Gates, and the capacity for enjoyment of Epicurus, who, you may know, wrote, "Not what we have, but what we enjoy constitutes our abundance." Well, I ask you, who could resist a dinner companion who throws into the conversation sentences like, "I'm so clever that sometimes I don't understand a single word of what I'm saying." The text gets a little bit more serious, saying that we should also transform our body into the greatest teachings of the Great Vehicle, which means, of course, the Mahayana. Foremost in importance, certainly in the Tibetan tradition, is the spiritual teacher, who is regarded as more important to a disciple than even the Buddha. So we're encouraged to change our body into anything that provides the basis for a spiritual friend, such as scriptures, a confidence in the law of cause and effect, ethical discipline, generosity, listening to teachings, a sense of shame, consideration for others, and intelligence that sees and knows the difference between what is meaningful and what meaningless. In other words, the 7 jewels of an exalted being. Then also transforming into training in morality meditative concentration and insight, particularly that leads to the experiential realization of emptiness. So we see our body transforming into all of these for the hell realm beings. If we do this, it becomes a cause for great love and compassion to arise in the minds of those beings, and on the basis of love and compassion, they can develop bodhicitta, or what Nam Kar Pel calls the awakening mind. So then, they start to become bodhisattvas and practice the six perfections, that is generosity, morality, patience, enthusiasm, concentration, and wisdom. Remember, when we talk about perfections here, we don't mean perfecting the action, but rather the mind behind the action. So the perfection of giving or generosity is not actually giving beings everything they need and want, but having the mind to give everything that helps them. Whether we can is one thing, having the firm intention to is another. So once the perfections are perfected, to coin a rather horrible phrase, one becomes a Buddha. So in essence, we are transforming ourselves to everything that leads to the beings becoming Buddhas. The two accumulations the text talks about are the accumulations of merit and wisdom, necessary for someone to become a Buddha. In his book, Gates to Pro-Buddha's Practice, Chögyal Rinpoche writes about the two accumulations like this. The act of benefiting is called the accumulation of merit, the effortful gathering of virtue. We harness the mind's duality using skillful methods, such as the first five of the six perfections, in a conceptual framework to create benefit within the relative dream experience. The effortless practice of awareness within the non-conceptual framework we call the accumulation of wisdom. Here, awareness refers to the non-conceptual recognition of the true nature of the three spheres. We don't fall into the extreme of affirming that everything exists as it appears, nor do we go to the other extreme of denying that anything is happening. Because the ground of our experience consists of both relative and absolute truth, both accumulations are essential to our practice. Both are indispensable for attaining enlightenment. We'll explain this a little bit fully next time, but now we have to leave things there for the time has run out. Thanks for joining the program today. I hope you'll be with us next time. Please dedicate any positive potential to the gaining enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. Thank you, and goodbye.